We now have a new challenge, perhaps the most monumental in recorded history. The opportunity to investigate a phenomenon that could change our destiny. A look at ourselves 1,000 years in the future.
We're going to examine and perhaps question some widely held theories of what may have happened to this Earth of ours. We're going to investigate some strange and bizarre events in the present, unbelievable happenings as fresh as today's headlines. And more important, perhaps, we're going to take a searching and scientific look into the future. We're reaching more and more out into space. Perhaps, as we may learn, someone, something, somewhere in space is reaching out to us.
Who the visitors are, where they're from, and what they want is unknown.
Bigfoot was attracting national attention and was now rapidly becoming the most intriguing mystery on the North American continent. Scientists and photography experts have examined the individual frames of this film and have come to the conclusion that the film and the creature are authentic.
Telepathy, psychokinesis, Bigfoot and black masses, UFOs and Atlantis, Kirlian photography, cloning, and cryonics. These subjects all have one thing indisputably in common. People want to know more about them. For mankind's future on Earth and beyond.
Welcome to After Dark Radio with your host, Brian Alvarez.
How's it going, everybody? Brian Alvarez here on After Dark Radio. It is September 20, 2015. Here on the Dark Matter Digital Network live every Sunday night, 9 Pacific, midnight Eastern. Got a very fun show for you here tonight. 2 hours live on the program. We're going to be joined in about a half hour by Rodney Asher. He is the man behind the documentary Room 237. According to Wikipedia here, Room 237 is a 2012 American documentary film directed by Rodney Asher about perceived meanings in Stanley Kubrick's film The Shining. The film includes footage from The Shining and other Kubrick films, along with discussions by a number of Kubrick enthusiasts. The film has 9 segments, each segment focusing on different elements within the film which may reveal hidden clues and hint at bigger themes. The film, produced by Tim Kirk, a lot of different theories about what Stanley Kubrick might have really been making a film about when he created The Shining, one of which, as we've talked about in previous weeks, is an individual who believes it is Stanley Kubrick's admission to the world that he faked the moon landing. Rodney Asher is going to be on the show a little bit later on tonight. We're also going to be talking about another documentary that he did that just came out this year, February of 2015, talking about sleep paralysis. It's very interesting because when I announced today that Rodney Asher was going to be on the show and was going to be talking about sleep paralysis, I had a surprising number of people actually contact me suddenly interested in listening to tonight's show because they have had bouts with sleep paralysis. And as I've mentioned here on the show, and as I'll talk to Rodney Asher about in the interview, I also at points in my life have had bouts of sleep paralysis. It's been many, many years. I would say probably it peaked maybe during my 20s, maybe about a half dozen times in my life. I had an incident with sleep paralysis. I have one friend who said that they were a chronic sufferer of sleep paralysis. And so we're going to be talking to Rodney Asher about that tonight as well. That's coming up in about a half hour. In the meantime, it's After Dark Radio. That means we've got a bunch of news stories to talk about here today. We're going to be taking open line phone calls here tonight, starting in just a couple of moments. And if you are listening to the show, maybe for the first time, or you've listened to the show many times but have never yet called in, everything you need to know about the program is available at our website, afterdarkradioshow.com, including all of the phone numbers. I'm going to throw them out here one time. If you want them, you can always find them on the front page of afterdarkradioshow.com. If you are west of the Rockies, you can give us a call at 425-488-0525. If you are east of the Rockies, the phone number is 425-482-1686. If you are from parts unknown, which essentially means anywhere in the known universe, not restricted by country, placement in terms of the Rocky Mountains. You can be anywhere. The phone number, 425-398-7353. And if you're a first-time caller, you have never called the program before, 425-398-7289. I should mention, it is open lines tonight. You can call about anything that is on your mind. Please try to restrict the pro wrestling questions. I answer pro wrestling questions every day on Wrestling Observer Live, so let's not do any here tonight. You can call about anything. However, if you have suffered from any sleep disturbances, sleep paralysis, that sort of thing, I would like to hear from you tonight, since I've had a lot of people asking about that. So that's obviously a subject to talk about. Any of the other news stories that we normally cover, you are welcome to discuss as well. And of course, everything else you need to know about the program is up at AfterDarkRadioShow.com as well. My Twitter handle, at Brian Alvarez. The email address, Brian@AfterDarkRadioShow.com. And the Facebook page, Facebook.com/AfterDarkRadioShow. Follow me on Twitter, like us on Facebook, and you'll always be up to date with what's going on in After Dark Radio. And I can kind of make an announcement right now before we go to the phones, but we got a lot of big things coming. We've got a brand new website that is going to be launching here in hopefully a few weeks. It's going to be a really cool website. If you've seen our current website, suffice to say, you can call it many things. Cool is probably not one of them. But the new website is going to be awesome, and once it launches, we're going to have a lot of really cool things on there, and I'll have even more big announcements about what's going on here at After Dark Radio. It's going to be really cool. So follow us there, like us on Facebook, and of course, if you have guest requests or you would like to be a guest, you are welcome to contact us on Facebook. Andrew Lutsky is the man behind the Facebook page. Contact him with your guest requests, or if you think you'd like to be a guest, you can contact him there. That will all be forwarded to our other producer, Kenneth, and he will work to get you on the show. We're booked up through October, but we will have open spots after that, so make sure you head over to AfterDarkRadioShow.com and the Facebook page and join the fun. To the phones, let's go to the Parts Unknown line. Open line starting right now. You are on the air. Who is this and where are you calling from?
Hey, Brian, this is Eric from somewhere in Minnesota.
Somewhere in Minnesota. What's going on, Eric?
One thing I want to call in and talk to you about is, it's been fun, Brian.
Time?
No, not time. It's been fun, Brian.
What does that mean?
Well, especially if it is true on Wednesday.
Oh, September 23rd. That's right. I've got a news story on that.
Well, I just wanted to call and say thank you for the memories and thank you for all the hours of entertainment you've given me over the last 5 or 6 years.
Well, Eric, I want to thank you for all of the calls that you have provided over the last couple of years. And yes, everybody, the story is September 23rd may be the end. And so this could be my final ever broadcast. I should have opened up with that CNN song. I'll have to play it before the show goes off the air here tonight. It's my wife's birthday, too. A real birthday present. The end of the world on September 23rd. So, Eric, thank you for calling me and reminding me. Thank you for wishing me well as we head on into the great unknown. I'll talk more about the end of the world here in a little while. Let's go to the east of the Rockies line. You're on the air. Who is this and where are you calling from?
This is Ryan from Cumberland, Maryland.
Ryan, this is the last time I may talk to you as well.
Well, I want to talk to you about September 23rd. I think it deals with that Hardon collider there that do simply put it on.
Excuse me, what did you call it?
Isn't it the Hardon collider?
Hadron.
Oh, okay, I guess I'm dyslexic. I got my R's and D's mixed up.
Sure, very understandable. So you think that the Large Hadron Collider is perhaps the catalyst for the end of the world on September 23rd?
Well, I don't think it should be the end of the world, but it could start the end of the world if they put it on high power. Like, I think that's what they're supposed to be doing. And supposedly these scientists have, like, all these crazy statues, like they're the gods of destruction and the gods of recreation, and they have also the 666 logo in the collider, which is sort of odd.
They have the 666 logo, you say, inside the Large Hadron Collider?
A lot of the articles I've been reading claim that. And also,
have you seen a picture of this logo, Ryan, or do you just believe what you've read?
I guess it must be true, because they also have all these crazy statues that deal with destroying and recreating. So why would they have those statues if it wasn't 666?
So why don't you send me Why don't you tweet me some of these articles or some of these photos, Ryan? I'd like to check it out for myself.
Okay. And also, did you hear anything about Hercules predicting that Giants would come in 2015?
Hercules?
Yeah, the movie Hercules, the cartoon that Disney did.
No, I have not heard of that prediction.
I think it deals with that collider, too, that it might open up a dimension of Giants.
Maybe he was talking about the football team, the Giants. Is that possible? Maybe they're going to the Super Bowl. Although, I guess 2015 Super Bowl is over. Well, Ryan, I want to thank you very much for the call. I don't know what to say about Hercules and the Giants coming, but... To the Parts Unknown line, you're on the air. Who is this and where are you calling from? Hello, you're on the air. I guess you're not on the air. Let's go to the first-time caller line. You are on the air. Who is this and where are you calling from?
Hi, Brian. This is Tyler calling from Chicago.
Tyler, what's going on?
I was listening to last week's show earlier today, and I wanted to weigh in on the Bernstein Bears.
Oh, yes, the Bernstein Bears.
Yeah. Well, as far as I can remember, it's always been Bernstein Bears, and that's how I read it, because I always thought the pun of stain. I always thought it was Bernstein. Wouldn't ever pronounce the N. But I think where people get steam from, I grew up uptown New Orleans, not a lot of Jewish people. So if you grew up in a white Jewish community, then you would know the name Stein or Steen, and you'd recognize that, not so much the name Stain. So maybe it depends on culture and upbringing of where people get this name that they brought up in their own mind from.
Well, I know that you have now called in saying that you remember Stain. I know that we had a librarian called in last week and insisted it was Bernstein. And other
also,
people.
The cartoon show, the theme song said the Bernstein Bears.
That's right. I did see that. Right. And I think that might be a big part of it. Was a lot of kids remember watching the cartoon and it was spelled Bernstein on the cartoon.
Interesting. It's always been Bernstein as far as I remember.
Yeah. Well, listen, I want to thank you very much for the call. That's all I can think is it was partially the cartoon and partially the other theory I had is that. I've seen this in various books where if you take a long sentence and you take out all the vowels and you jumble all the consonants together, the human brain can still fill in the blanks and read the sentence very, very quickly. And so I think it's part of that where when kids see Baron ST and they see the N at the end, I think for a lot of people, not just kids, but like mostly adults probably, their brains fill in Stein, Frankenstein, Frankenstein, Bernstein. I think that's what the brain does when they see those letters. Or, hey, some people insist it's Bernstein. Others people insist it's Bernstein. So maybe these conspiracy theorists, maybe there are two timelines. Some of us were brought up in one and some of us were brought up in the other. I think people just couldn't read cursive, filled in the blanks. But who knows? Some people insist that it was never Bernstein. It bothers them a lot. To the east of the Rockies line, you're on the air. Who is this and where are you calling from?
Hey, this is Tim in Collinsville, Illinois.
Yes, Tim.
Hey, well, I guess I'd have to agree that I would have thought it was Bernstein, but I can totally believe it's Bernstein.
Yeah, I never really thought about it. I just remember looking at that list, and that was the only one. I will say this. That was the only one that really stuck out to me. A lot of the other ones, like, you know, people think that they were taught to spell definitely a different way. I mean, I think that's just people don't know how to spell. A lot of these, I think, you know, people don't remember dates exactly. But the Bernstein one was one where when I read it, I was like, okay, there's no way it's Stain, but it was. So that was a weird one.
Yeah, I'd say that was the weirdest. You had mentioned sleep paralysis earlier.
Yes.
And I'm kind of unfamiliar with that, but I definitely say that, like, you know, a very common unpleasant dream is like when you're trying to run but can't, or trying to lift something but can't. Is that, what exactly do you mean by sleep paralysis?
Well, what it is, there, as we'll talk about with Rodney Asher tonight, there's a couple of different types of sleep paralysis. One seems to be a physiological type of sleep paralysis where you can come up with various scientific logical explanations. And the most common one is when you are in the middle of REM sleep, your body is essentially paralyzed. And the theory is that if for some reason you wake up during REM sleep, you'll be alert, but you'll be paralyzed because your body is still in the state of paralysis from the REM sleep. That's I guess, the scientific explanation for it. And that's the one that I always had. I would wake up and I couldn't open my eyes, but my eyes were like very, very barely open. So I could kind of sort of see the room, but I couldn't move any portion of my body. And you're trying really hard to move something and nothing is moving. And you're trying. And then all of a sudden, like, bam, all of a sudden you can move and you wake up and you're like, oh my God, that absolutely sucked. That was the kind that I had. Other people have a type of sleep paralysis where they feel like they have woken up, but they can't move, just like I did. But there is the added dimension, the paranormal aspect, where they feel like there is somebody in the room with them. They see like a shadow or a form, and the shadow or the form comes over and sits on them or lays on them or puts weight on them. And it's far more terrifying, and it feels more like a ghost sort of deal. That's the other, and they're two completely different. I mean, they're very similar, but they're different. I never had the haunted body, whatever, but many people report that. My dad reported that.
Huh. Thankfully, I have not experienced either one of those. Yeah, Ryan was talking about strange statues by the Large Hadron Collider.
Yes.
I'd recently stumbled across, it made me think of the Baphomet, you know, the goat-headed dude or whatever. And I don't know. I just thought maybe I'll even talk about that one night. Or
have you seen these statues?
I'll get into the history of that.
Have you seen these statues that are allegedly near the collider?
No, absolutely not. But when he said that, it just reminded me of, you know, I could imagine, you know, this place surrounded by, I don't know, cultish statues or whatever. I just pictured a big Baphomet at the entrance of the LHC.
Interesting. Well, I can imagine that. I haven't seen it. But I want to thank you very much for the call. Hopefully Ryan will send in some photos of these alleged statues around the Large Hadron Collider and also the 666 logo, as he called it. I would like to check that out as well. Phone lines are open, everybody, if you want to give us a call tonight. All of the numbers are up on the front page of AfterDarkRadioShow.com. We have four lines, east and west of the Rockies, as well as parts unknown and a first-time caller line. And let's head to east of the Rockies. You're on the air. Who is this and where are you calling from?
Hey, Brian. This is John from Memphis, Tennessee.
Yes, John.
Hey, I was going to talk about this sleep paralysis thing. Have you ever heard of the, while you're sleeping, the marching sound in your head, in your head while you're sleeping? Have you ever heard of that situation?
No. Explain this to me.
All right, it used to happen. It still sometimes happens to me. I'm sorry, I'm driving now. I'm just leaving my best friend's house.
All right, don't get in a wreck.
I won't get in a wreck. I got you on speaker, Brian.
All right, very good.
All right. While you're sleeping, depends on if you sleep on your side. And normally, it does sleep on my. If I sleep on my side. If you are in a deep sleep, you will hear marching in one part of your ear. It sounds like a troop is marching along the side of you.
I have never heard that. Are you sure you're not just hearing your heartbeat?
I thought of that, but I've heard this. I thought I was the only one that heard this, but then about 5 or 6 years ago, Art Bell talked about the same situation about the marching sleep. While you're laying down sleeping, you sometimes hear the marching sound.
So did Art hear this, or was someone on the show talking about this?
It was a combination of both. Art was talking about this. Ask your guy, I don't know if this was a live one or if this is pre-taped, but ask the guy about that marching sound while you're sleeping.
Now you hear it, so it feels like you're dreaming, or do you wake up and hear it? Like, how does this relate to being awake and being asleep?
All right, if you are laying down, and if you're sleeping, and then you wake up, I kid you not, when you just waking up, you will hear, if sometimes for me, you will hear a marching sound, like the marching sound of...
Does it sound like mini steps or one person?
No, like a marching, like a troop marching, like...
So there's a lot of them.
Yes. I'm not kidding. I wish I would. I don't kid about that, Brian. I know it sounds crazy.
No, I believe you. I just have never heard of this before. But you say that other people, including Art, have mentioned this.
Yes, I do remember. I've been a big fan of Art since I was about 20 years, listening to him on and off for 20 years. And he talked about it. I know many years ago when I was in Louisville, studying. I think this was about 10 years ago when I heard this, when I was in Louisville and stuff like that. And he was talking about you. I think it was one of his callers, and Art had said, yeah, that too, about sleeping and laying down in the marching step. Look it up. I don't know if you have looked it up and talk about it, but yeah, I have had that happen to me hundreds of times, and the sleep paralysis a couple of times. I think it was the physiological one.
So you didn't have a ghost sitting on you?
A what?
You didn't have a ghost sitting on you. You didn't have that kind of sleep paralysis.
No, not that type of sleep paralysis, Brian. I'm not crazy.
Wow, you're calling all these people that believe a ghost sat on them crazy, John?
I ain't saying they're crazy. I'm not saying they're crazy. I've never seen a ghost. I've seen weird things, but I've never seen a ghost. And weird things that happened to me, Brian. Trust me, you know. You have known me for a little while. I know that I have seen a lot of weird stuff, Brian. But I have never had a ghost sit on me, but I've had sleep paralysis happen to me, and I've had laying down and the marching step. I've looked that up one time, Brian. You'll be interested in it. See, a lot of people have done that. Go on Twitter and ask people that, Brian.
All right. Well, listen, John, first off, I want to drive safe. I want to thank you very much for the call. Anybody listening to this who has also experienced the marching sound in their head while they're sleeping, or I guess just after waking up, alert me on Twitter that you've had the same experience, or give me a call and tell me more about it. I should note another weird sleeping thing. It's called exploding head syndrome. I mentioned this about a year ago because it appears it happened to my grandmother. She thought that she'd had a stroke or something, and at the end of the day, it was, I guess, believed to be exploding head syndrome. And what that essentially is when you're asleep, all of a sudden you will be awakened by this terribly loud crashing sound, this BAM sound. And maybe you think somebody's in your house, maybe you think something exploded, and in reality, there's nothing there. I vaguely recall many, many, many years ago, probably decades ago, this may have happened to me once or twice, where you just seemed to hear this extremely loud bang, and it was actually nothing. But it's actually a thing. It's called exploding head syndrome. You can Google it if you'd like. And my grandmother, apparently, there's a Wikipedia page on it, believe it or not. Exploding head syndrome is a condition in which a person perceives loud, imaginary noises or an explosive feeling when falling asleep or waking up. In addition to noise, some people report fear and seeing flashes of light. It is classified as a parasomnia in the 2005 International Classification of Sleep Disorders. Is an unusual type of auditory hallucination in that it occurs in people who are not fully awake. Neither the cause nor the mechanism of exploding head syndrome is known. As of 2015, there had not been sufficient studies conducted to make clear statements about prevalence, nor who tends to suffer EHS. As of 2014, no clinical trials had been conducted to determine if treatments are safe and effective. A few cases Reports had been published describing treatment of small numbers of people with various drugs, as well as simply education and reassurance. Case reports have been published since 1876, when this fella Silas Mitchell described, quote, sensory discharges in a patient. The phrase exploding head syndrome was coined in a 1920 report by the Welsh physician and psychiatrist Robert Armstrong Jones. So there you go, exploding head syndrome. Probably something not a lot of people have heard of, but my grandmother actually experienced it. So that's the story there. Let's see. The statues outside CERN is one of Shiva, the Hindu god. Now, why is a statue of Shiva, the Hindu god, outside of CERN? September 23rd, everybody. It's allegedly going to be the day. I got a lot of news stories here that I'm going to get into after the interview here tonight. A lot of interesting things to talk about, including a scientist who claims there was life on Mars, but a catastrophic event wiped it out. This is from Louis Dadernell, a space agency fellow. I'll talk about that. A little bit about diet linked to brain power. And I should mention this because this will be exciting and terrifying to some of you because I've done this before and it's apparently freaked some people out. So I'll give you fair warning now. I have more recordings of these weird, unexplained trumpet sounds that have been heard all over the world, including by listeners of this program. I'm going to play some. I've got three of them. I'm going to play some of them on the show tonight, so you can get ready for that. Also got some stories about alleged pterodactyl footage. And yes, is a comet about to destroy the Earth on September 23rd? A lot of stuff here coming up, everybody. But first off, we are going to head to a break. And when we come back, we're going to be joined by Rodney Asher. He's the director of Room 237. We're going to talk a lot about... What are we going to talk about? It's not just the film. It is the whole concept of subliminal imagery. We're going to talk a little bit about theories of a faked moon landing, which, as many of you who listen to this show are aware, I am not a believer that we faked the moon landing, but we're going to talk about that. A lot of other subjects related to this film, The Shining, and we'll also be talking about sleep paralysis. Rodney Asher has done a documentary on sleep paralysis, so that's going to be a lot of fun. So we'll talk about that and so much more, and then we'll be back later on with news. So we're going to head to a break. Back in just a moment, After Dark Radio here on the Dark Matter Digital Network. We are back here on After Dark Radio. Brian Alvarez here, After Dark Radio on the Dark Matter Digital Network. Very happy today to be joined by Rodney Asher. We are going to be talking his documentary film, Room 237, as well as a number of other topics. And Rodney, how are you doing tonight?
I'm great. Great to talk to you, Brian.
A lot of questions about this film. A lot of questions about this film. I don't even really know where to begin. Room 237. It is a documentary about, as it notes here, perceived meanings in Stanley Kubrick's film, The Shining. And there are a lot of perceived meanings that people have found in the film, The Shining. And I guess we should start at the very beginning. How did you become interested enough to want to create a documentary about people's ideas about what they saw when they watched The Shining?
Well, I mean, The Shining has always been, you know, a movie that I found, you know, completely fascinating, you know, ever since I was scared out of the theater, out of the screening that I snuck into, you know, when I was 12. And through the years, it's a movie that stuck with me. I know, you know, a couple of years before I did Room 237, I did a short documentary called The S from Hell, which was about people who had childhood phobias of the Screen Gems logo. And, you know, I had some fun with that, and the notion that people could be so profoundly affected, you know, by well, pop culture was really interesting to me, you know, more than people talking about things that, more than people saying, this is my favorite movie, this movie is really cool, but by people who found these things to have more weight than that, to be more important than that, started to get really interesting. And, you know, a friend of mine forwarded to me one of these really deep interpretive looks at The Shining, and I immediately knew that I wanted to do some sort of project about it, because I had a, you know, I've always been a big Kubrick fan, and I had a book called Inside a Film Artist's Maze, Stanley Kubrick, by Thomas Alan Nelson, and there's a passage in there where he talks about the numerology of The Shining, you know, especially about the number 237, and then that became a window for comparing it to 2001 A Space Odyssey, and gets into all sort of themes about mirroring. So that really stuck with me, the fact that, you know, this guy could write a couple paragraphs just on this one number in the movie, you know, and how many other details are in the film. You know, it's kind of mind-boggling. And, you know, Bill Blakemore had written an essay about, you know, the Native American themes in the film back in the 80s. So very quickly, me and Tim Kirk, who produced the film, were able to find just a surprisingly large number of these theories that were more complicated and, you know, more uncanny than, you know, any kind of film criticism that I had seen. And, you know, at a certain point, you know, I took a step back and said, well, is The Shining the best example of this stuff? You know, 2001 is probably more plainly metaphorical on its surface. But, you know, there's been a lot written about 2001, and, you know, certainly it's an important movie to a lot of people, and people spent a lot of time trying to figure it out. But The Shining seemed to generate more of this kind of stuff. And for me, the fact that, you know, it's a horror movie, and it's one that to that point hadn't been taken as seriously as 2001, made it all the more interesting, you know, especially since, you know, very quickly there seemed to be a pretty good metaphor that, you know, that the Overlook Hotel is to Jack Torrance what The Shining is, you know, to many of its own viewers.
Now, you mentioned, and if you watch the documentary, Room 237, there are, I believe it's 9 theories that are expounded by different people here in this film. And my presumption would be that if you actually tried to put together every single theory about The Shining, there would be far more than 9. Did you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, what was the original number, and how did you narrow it down to the 9 that you chose?
Well, I mean, actually, the movie's in 9 chapters. There are 5 people who are talking about their notions, and some of them are more complicated than just one theory. But, you know, we try to put together a kind of definitive list, but quickly that became impossible, not the least of which is because the work continued to be being created as we worked on the film, and people are continuing to write about The Shining and explore its quarters. So, you know, at a pretty early stage in the production, you know, I realized I'm not going to be able to get them all in. But what I want to do is do a number that's large enough to, you know, talk to vouch for how much is out there, but, you know, small enough to allow us to go into pretty big detail on each of them. You know, and these 5 people, these 9 chapters, seem to be kind of the magic number. And there are a couple of points in the film where I try to suggest, you know, just how this is like the tip of the iceberg. There's a moment where John Phil Ryan is talking about him doing a lot of work reading other people's theories about The Shining online. And I show, I don't know, 9 or 12 screens, many of which, you know, are people's sites, people's ideas about The Shining that don't get reflected in the movie. And even within the people we're talking to, like Julie Kearns, who talked a little bit about the Minotaur in the film, has written so much about the movie. I mean, I could have done 1 3-hour film just about her notions, but there's a point where I show this map that she created. And if you read it, there'll be things that we don't get a chance to discuss in the movie, but that are very provocative on their own. Like in the big party scene in the Gold Room, she identifies women as the old and the young woman from Room 237. and she found them and plotted them in a diagram of the big formal party in the ballroom.
Now, before we go any further, I want you to give the listeners who may not have seen The Shining a synopsis of the film, and then I want to talk a little bit about some of the differences that Stanley Kubrick, I mean, he changed the original story by Stephen King. There are a lot of differences. Like, for example, there's no maze in Stephen King's book, but there's a maze, obviously, in The Shining film. So tell everybody a little bit about what the film is about and what kind of changes were reflected.
All right. Although people do talk a lot about the changes, but I think the changes he made are significant to the story that he wanted to tell. But cut him a little bit of slack. You know, it is not unusual for a Hollywood movie to make dramatic changes.
No. Yeah. I don't know if there are any movies that have no changes from the novel. It'd probably be 1%.
Well, and if you're going to talk about Stephen King even, you know, I think he sued the makers of The Lawnmower Man to change the way the credits were written, because that movie really has absolutely nothing to do with the story that it was based on. I think, you know, maybe they found the cheapest story that they could license from him so that they could use the name Stephen King prominently on the poster. The Shining is a story of a family, is the story of a family that moves to sort of an isolated hotel up in the mountains of Colorado. The father is a retired school teacher. In fact, he was sort of forced into retirement, after having a bad experience at the school, and he's hoping to be able to write a novel or a play while they're, you know, sort of isolated, watching this hotel over the winter. You know, the mom, is going to work in the hotel too, and they have a 5-year-old son, Danny, who has a psychic ability that is, you know, what's called The Shining. It's the premise that's where the name of the story comes from. And as the winter comes on, complications ensue. The father starts seeing ghosts. He becomes obsessed with the history of the hotel. When Danny has a run-in with, you know, a woman in one of the supposedly deserted hotel rooms, the mom wants to abandon the hotel, take Danny to see a doctor, and that's kind of the straw that breaks the camel's back and, you know, puts the family at odds with each other. And by the end of the movie, he's chasing them around the hotel with an axe, trying to kill them. Some of the more dramatic changes from the book to the movie, there's little things, you know, like what the mom looks like. You know, it's Shelley Duvall in the movie. In the book, she's described as a blonde former cheerleader. And Shelley Duvall is a lot of things, but she's not a blonde cheerleader type. We talked about the maze that, you know, was a creation for the final act of the movie. In the book, there is no maze. That chase happens within the hotel itself. There are some prominent hedge animals that sort of come to life and chase Danny at a certain point when he's playing outside. I mean, for me, the scariest part of the book didn't even make it into the movie, where Danny is sort of in a snow tunnel in the playground, and he senses that something's behind him while he's under the snow. And I think he's afraid that the snow is going to collapse over him and nobody even knows that he's out there. And then maybe the most significant change, you know, is that Jack is redeemed at the end of the book, you know, that he resists the hotel, and the hotel actually explodes in a fire because they had forgotten to tend to the furnace. So, a fair amount of changes, and certainly, you know, a lot of people talking about the book versus the movie kind of focus on those changes as clues to, you know, what Stanley Kubrick was really getting up to.
Now, before we get back to the movie, you mentioned earlier the Screen Gems logo, and
if
you Google Screen Gems logo, the second thing that comes up in the search suggestions is Screen Gems logo scary. This is a thing. And I've had a lot of people. I once did a show. I've done several shows where you invite callers to call in with scary stories or scary memories. And the one that people keep bringing up is Unsolved Mysteries. The theme from Unsolved Mysteries scares them to this day. I had not heard Screen Gems logo, but apparently that's a big one. Tell us more about people's fear of this.
Well, you know, this is the animated logo for the Screen Gems company that used to appear at the end of TV shows, mostly from the 60s and 70s. You know, kids from my generation remember seeing it on reruns of things like The Monkees or Bewitched or even The Flintstones. But there is something, you know, a little off-putting about it. You know, I think it was cell animation, but it's very severe and geometric, and it looks like a precursor to, you know, primitive digital animation. And the theme is this kind of eerie synthesizer music. It was actually created by, I think his name was William Sade, who was a real pioneer. And in fact, he also did the popular theme for the coffee percolator. Maxwell, so he was really, you know, an important guy in working with like found sounds in his music. And the song for me wasn't frightening so much as really melancholy. It was alien, but also melancholy, like a Martian funeral. So when I came across people's stories of being afraid of it, you know, I had a real flashback to, you know, being 3 years old and watching hours of television alone and being puzzled by some of the stuff in between the shows. Like for me, it felt like seeing the machine language behind the television. Like if when your operating system breaks in the computer and you see all the zeros and ones.
Sure, yeah.
Something kind of like that. Like I was seeing the language that like the electronics underneath the television would use to speak natively. So I really connected when I came across people's accounts of being frightened by that logo. And again, it wasn't as frightening to me, but it was very, very puzzling. And actually, if you go, there's a website called the Closing Logos Group, and it's like a forum for people who are really fascinated, mostly by vintage logos. And they go through every iteration, they catalog them very carefully, and they also rank by scare factor. Because the Screen Gems S from Hell, you know, isn't the only logo that has given people problems. There's also the Viacom Via Doom. There's the Neon Mickey was for a Disney home video logo. The Paramount Closet Killer. It goes on and on. It's a pretty fascinating little world.
I don't have anything like that, but I do know that I was born in 1975. And so okay. I have very, very vague memories of the 70s. But when I go back and I look at things from the 70s, I kind of, my memory is tripped a little bit. And a lot of the stuff from the 70s just seems weird. I don't know if it's the color scheme or the, I don't know what it is, low quality, lo-fi. I don't know what it is, but it just, the 70s to me seems like it was really weird. You know, I don't even know how to explain it. When I just look back, it's like, this is just weird stuff.
Yeah, well, I mean, there was something about the technology, too. I mean, I'm thinking this stuff is all for me. It comes also like there was like one season of The Twilight Zone that was shot on video instead of on film. And although it's less cinematic and grand than the other seasons, there's something stranger and more frightening. Like it's a live closed circuit broadcast from like another dimension. And there's a similar kind of quality to, there was a show on PBS that, you know, was kind of an alternate version, sort of a hipper version of Sesame Street called The Electric Company. And there's some strange primitive computer animation, you know, that's part of that.
Was everyone on drugs? What was it?
Yeah, well, who can say, but you know, it feels like there's a ghost in the machine. And, you know, I actually tried to touch on a little bit of that feeling, you know, in my new film, The Nightmare, getting into how the supernatural is sometimes associated with, like, consumer electronics.
We're going to talk about that here in a bit, because I have some things I want to ask you. I haven't seen that yet, but I do want to ask you about that. Going back to The Shining, by the way, one of the weird things about The Shining is the movie came out in 1980, and I don't know how old the little boy was in the movie at the time. Mm-hmm. He was probably, I don't know what, six?
I think he was 7 or 8. But
six,
yeah.
7, 8? All I know is when I look back at the school pictures of me in 1980, I look just like that kid. It's kind of creepy. But anyway.
Yeah, I had one of those haircuts too.
Oh yeah, I think everybody did actually. Maybe that's the thing. It was the haircut at that time. But anyway, going back to the film here, a lot of different theories. And one of the things that, I mean, I don't know. I guess I'll just ask you. Any of these theories you personally put much stock into?
Well, I mean, that's always the tricky question. And, you know, I would preface, you know, any answer by saying, in the making of the film, I don't necessarily think my opinion about any of them is all that important.
Of course not.
If I discovered that one of them was exactly what Stanley Kubrick intended, or one was just completely not connected, I don't think I would go back and change it if I had. You know, if time and trouble was not a factor, because, you know, for me, what's most interesting is the spell that this film cast on people and the way it drove them to search for answers. You know, that said, some of them seem less likely on the surface, but I mean, every time I would kind of get into them, you know, as details accumulated, they would become more and more plausible. There's also stuff that, you know, I have no idea whether it's true, but I find it very meaningful and very interesting. Like, there's talk about, you know, continuity errors that are made in the film. You know, like chairs that disappear from the background and that sort of thing. And there's, you know, kind of a idea that there's one suggestion that, you know, ghosts are moving the furniture around. But there's another idea that I really love, which is that, like a musician who's using dissonance, that by creating these imperfections, he's trying to, you know, make the audience feel slightly unease and not necessarily to understand why, by hitting these, you know, kind of wrong keys on the piano.
Or, you know, what? Let me say something about that right there, because I have spent years working to try to improve the audio quality of this radio program. Mm-hmm. And many times when I've made a change, I've had people say, I can't hear any difference. They tell me that I'm crazy. Like, maybe you can hear it, but nobody else can. And I've always kind of thought, they're right. If I did an A-B side to side, I'll bet that most people can't tell the difference. But my feeling has always been, if I get it to be the best it can be, nobody's going to notice, but they're going to hear it deep down. And I guess the reason I bring that up is because, yeah, maybe 99% of people don't notice that a chair disappears here or something gets switched around here. You're not supposed to notice, but deep down you do notice, and it adds, in the example of The Shining, a creepiness factor to the whole thing.
Well, sure, and I would think that, you know, most of the people who I talk to in the film, when they're describing the things that they've noticed, they're not saying that the rest of us are dumb for not seeing them. You know, it's only through watching it again and again in slow motion that they pick them up. You know, but the idea is that they would accumulate, you know, sort of subconsciously.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that actually brings me to another thing right here that I want to talk about, which is in the documentary, Room 237, I can't remember who it was, but somebody is referencing a book called Subliminal Seduction.
Oh,
boy, do I remember that book. I remember all of the book. Wilson Brian Keyes was the guy who, he wrote the Subliminal Seduction. He wrote another one called The Clam Plate Orgy. He wrote another one, The Hidden Persuaders. Actually, he may not have written that one. I think that might have been another guy that he kind of was influenced by. But the point of this is, I remember these. And maybe that's part of this stuff from the 70s that I thought was so creepy, because I read those books, and it's all about how all of these advertising companies are putting these subliminal messages in advertising, like print ads. And it was pointing out that, like, a lot of the alcohol ads that you see, those aren't photographs of glasses with ice in them. Those are paintings, and they've painted in skulls, for example, or sexual imagery. And I remember when I was younger, I read these books and I was just like blown away, thinking, oh my God, is this true? And the idea was, you don't see it, but you see it. Your subconscious notices it, and it attracts you to these products. I don't know, looking back, if there was anything to it. This guy may have been completely out of his mind. He convinced me when I was younger. But any thoughts? I mean, have you ever read that book, or did you follow up on that when it was brought up in the film?
Yeah. Well, this wasn't the kind of documentary where I would try to, you know, go back to the Kubrick estate and see if that book was on the shelf and if that was something that had, you know, been discussed in the production of the movie, or what ad agency did he meet with and when. But I absolutely remember that book from seeing it, like, on supermarket carousels. And, you know, putting it in context for The Shining, those are both artifacts, you know, of the 70s and of sort of a real mainstream interest in the paranormal. Like, I would see that book, I imagine it would be on the carousel next to a book about the Loch Ness Monster and another about
Bigfoot, you
know, psychic phenomena. And The Shining when people talk about The Shining, the first thing they'll say is the axe and the ghost. But, you know, at the center of that book is ESP, you know, which is so close to the world of subliminal seduction. And my layman's understanding of Stanley Kubrick's interests, I would be very surprised if he was not aware of that book, if he had not read it and had gone through it. No matter, I've got, you know, I wouldn't have any idea what he thought about it, but I'm sure he totally seems like the kind of person to me who would have taken a huge interest in reading it.
One of the things about the film when I was watching it was, I don't know if I bought any of the stories completely. However, I think it was very, very clear that there were continuity errors in the film that were there by design. I think that some of them probably were just continuity errors. I mean, when some people were explaining certain things that they'd seen in the film, and they're like, oh, this is, you know, this was clearly done by design. Some of them, I thought, maybe that one was just an accident. Clearly, there were some things in there. I mean, the theory that it was the film had a subtext of the destruction of the American Indians. This was one of the theories.
Mm-hmm.
And when I watched the documentary, it was kind of like, okay, clearly he deliberately put Native American imagery all over the film. But to me, I would argue that it's more likely that the story itself was that this structure was built on a Native American burial ground. And so because of the film, because of that fact in the film, you put a lot of imagery in the movie to get people thinking about that in the back of their minds. But I don't know if I see anything beyond that.
Yeah, well, I mean, you're not alone. And that was probably where I was before, you know, before I wandered into my maze. But more of that stuff, but the closer I look, the more of that stuff starts to appear. There's a draft of the script that has a scene that didn't make it into the movie, but where Jack discovers a lot of things in the room that had a lot of the things at his desk had been moved, and there are like Native American artifacts, like feathers and like arrowheads and stuff, arranged in some pattern, and like putting subliminal seduction into historical context with the making of The Shining. If you think about the 70s, like the Native American movement was, the political movement was getting really, was also becoming very mainstreamed in the 70s.
Like that is true.
When Marlon Brando, you know, sent a Native American to reject his Academy Award. That's when they took over Alcatraz. So it certainly would have been something, another thing that Kubrick would have been aware of in those days.
The other very notable one was the belief that this was, I don't know if an explanation, an admittance, what the term would be, but essentially it was Kubrick's way of saying, I was responsible for helping fake the moon landing. And again, I should note, it's not necessarily the theory that he helped fake it. I guess the theory is that we did go to the moon, but he helped create the actual footage that was shown to the American public, and it was claimed, you know, this is footage from the moon, but there actually was no footage of us on the moon, and he had to create it on a sound stage. Is that essentially the theory?
Yeah, well, you know, that's Jay Widener's theory, and he talks, you know, pretty eloquently about it in the film and in his own work. It is very much, we went to the moon, but for multiple reasons, and I think one of them was, you know, to obscure our technology, you know, from the Soviets, that they filmed the footage separately, and that The Shining is either a place where Stanley Kubrick is confessing or boasting or joking about it. I think Jay frames it, you know, as sort of a confession. And clearly that's, you know, sort of the most attention-getting theory that we've
sure.
Seen in the movie.
Well, I mean, to be fair, when I first heard about it, I mean, I don't believe for one second that we did not go to the moon. Now, maybe someone could convince me that we did go to the moon, but we faked the footage. I could maybe believe that, because just the idea that, I mean, there's proof. I mean, you could, as far as I know, I mean, you can look through certain telescopes nowadays and see the site of the moon landing. We were in the middle of a Cold War, and I don't feel that it's possible that, like, other countries could have been monitoring our trip to the moon, and if we didn't go, not have said anything about it. All of the people involved in covering this up, no one ever having said, I just don't believe any of that, but I mean, maybe we went and they faked the footage for whatever reason. That I could maybe believe.
Well, sure. And it's, you know, it's not necessarily where I'm coming from to defend the notion that Kubrick faked the moon landing. But one thing that I have spent a lot of time thinking about is that if in some way the Overlook Hotel is meant to represent America, in a lot of readings of the movie, the moon landing is a big part of, you know, Americana, you know, again in the late 70s. And something I discovered, I think after I made the film, is that Kubrick had been rumored to have faked the moon landing for a long time. I would say, I think the Flat Earth Society I had read were the first people to pin it on him shortly after the moon landing themselves. And clearly, if you're looking for someone to execute something like that, you know, the guy who shot 2001: The Space Odyssey would at least be on the short list. And Kubrick has been described, you know, as sort of a conspiracy theorist himself, and somebody who kept meticulous files of everything ever written by him. So he would have been aware that he had been rumored to have been involved in it, which to me makes the fact that, you know, he decided to, you know, frame that sweater with the Apollo 11 rocket that squarely in the middle of the frame, that he would have made the connection. You know, to what end, you know, who can say? But I don't think that allusions to the moon landing, you know, within The Shining is absurd at all. I think it's perfectly plausible that, you know, that he would hit that in that sequence, he was saying something about the moon landing, you know, and I'll leave it to others to decide, you know, what it is that he said.
Sure. I mean, I could believe that maybe, as you noted, he knew all of these stories. He knew he had been accused. And so in the making of the movie, he just thought, let me throw in a couple of Easter eggs and I'll give them some evidence.
Could be. you know, we all start to speculate pretty quickly because it's such juicy territory.
Now, Kubrick died, I believe, in 1999. And did he ever publicly comment on, I mean, obviously this film came out long after he died, but I'm sure that some of these theories have been around for a long time. The Apollo one, as you noted, had been around probably since the very early 70s. Has he ever commented on any of the imagery that he put in any of these films, or was he the kind of guy that he clearly did some of this by design, but it was up to you to figure out, and he was never going to answer the question for you?
He talked a little bit about this stuff once in a while. Like there's a book, I think it's just called Kubrick by Michael Cement, a French writer, where he describes a little bit of it. But I mean, more prominently are quotes where he talks about not wanting to answer those sorts of questions. I think there's one where there's a quote of his where he says, you know, that the Mona Lisa wouldn't be improved if there was a little plaque next to it that said, you know, she's smiling because she's thinking about, you know, how cute her lover might have looked as a child.
Sure.
You know, that leaving room for people's interpretation was important to him. You know, I think there's another where he said, you know, I don't want to, you know, describe all the metaphors and allegories in the movie because it would sort of force the viewer to look at things in only one way. So I think kind of like David Lynch, he's somebody who tried, you know, to avoid talking about the allegorical or metaphoric qualities of his movies. But clearly, you know, he's working on a symbolic level, you know, from the beginning. I mean, his very first, you know, feature, Fear and Desire, he cast the same actors as American soldiers and then as the Germans that they're fighting. You know, and I don't think that was just for budgetary reasons. He's saying something about the nature of war. You know, and every one of his movies has, you know, these sort of visual puzzles within them. And clearly, you know, he did a version of Lolita, and he worked with Nabokov. And, you know, that guy was the king of wordplay, you know, in both on screen and in the page. So that kind of stuff interested him.
I would think, too, that if people, for example, went through all of my audio shows and they found all of these things, these whatever, that they believed that I had put in here, but I actually hadn't, but they attributed it to my genius, I'd probably be like, hey, great. Why tell them otherwise?
Well, exactly. And, you know, I found, you know, myself after I made the film, you know, I've done, you know, a couple of these interviews, and I usually try to be, you know, as frank as possible. So there are times where I'll say something in an hour after I get off, after I finish the conversation, I said, wait a minute, it wasn't X, it was Y. But I couldn't remember Y while I was talking. You know, so sometimes you'll find yourself trying to say something accurate or clever or interesting, but at the end of the day, just settle for coherent. And, you know, I've read, you know, people have written things about 237 that contain ideas that are much smarter or more interesting than anything I came up with while I was working on it. And it's pretty tempting to just take it.
Yeah, just sure, take it.
And I'm sure directors have, you know, or the other way, they're afraid of looking, you know, pretentious, you know, so that they dismiss that stuff and try to be more matter of fact, you know, which are all reasons that, you know, I would kind of say, you know, what a filmmaker says about his work is interesting and you should take it into account, but even that's never going to be completely definitive.
I want to talk about The Nightmare. I've not had a chance to see this one here yet, but it's about sleep paralysis. And my understanding is that you, at one point in your life, had an incident involving sleep paralysis. And I guess let's just start with that. What happened to you?
Sure. Well, I was, you know, maybe just a year out of college, and I was living in a 4-bedroom house with a couple of roommates on the edge of the woods in Miami. And, you know, I just woke up at maybe 3 or 4 in the morning, and I couldn't move. And, you know, I couldn't speak. I couldn't shout out for help. I mean, my roommates were just on the other side of the wall. And at a certain point, I sensed, you know, like a presence outside of the house, like kind of coming out of the woods. And after, you know, a few moments, there was this figure in the room with me, and it looked like a living three-dimensional shadow, just a jet black silhouette of a person, like no features. You know, and it felt evil in the, like, religious sense of the word. You know, and it walked very slowly and very calmly, like right over to my bed until it was just leaning over my face. And, you know, I was trying to get away and to scream, and I couldn't do any of that. And then somehow, you know, time just kind of stopped. And when I kind of came out of this fugue state, you know, I could move again, and I got up and I walked around and I breathed heavy. And, you know, I had no idea what had happened. I was sure it was, you know, a supernatural experience, you know, and I believed it for years until I, you know, read about sleep paralysis as sort of a physiological thing that happens to people, you know, where you're in a twilight between waking and sleep. But, you know, a couple of years ago, as I reintroduced myself to the topic, I was kind of fascinated and, you know, a little creeped out by how similar all the things that people saw seemed to be, and these recurring characters that, that kind of appear to people, you know, which for a lot of folks, you know, is reason to believe that what's happening to them is, you know, not just, you know, a weird kind of nightmare or a sleep disorder, but is, you know, that they're seeing something in some way, you know, real.
I once, this hasn't happened in years, but I'd say probably a half dozen times in my life, I've had the sleep paralysis where I guess I'm awake. My eyes don't open all the way, and I totally cannot move. I guess the best way to describe it is if you imagine what it would be like if you woke up during REM sleep, where your eyes are like closed, but they're maybe partially open, and maybe your eyes are fluttering or whatever, and you just cannot move. That used to happen to me, and I would be aware that I couldn't move. And I would, I mean, it's hard to describe what you're seeing because your eyes are just so weird. But after, I don't know, a minute, I would wake up and then, like, I could move everything again. And it would be weird because I would be thinking about trying to move, but I couldn't. And then finally I could. But I never, there was never the presence or anything like that. But my dad, when he was young, there was a cellar in his house. And I remember I saw it once, and it was like, this was straight out of a Stephen King film. Like, why he even went down here to sleep, I don't even know. He was out of his mind. But he was down there sleeping, and he had the sleep paralysis where a figure came into the room, and it sat on him. And it was right on his chest, and he said he couldn't breathe, and he couldn't move. And finally, he pushed whatever it was off, and he ran upstairs. He never went down there again. This is my dad. So that's two completely different things. What have you concluded after all of this? You mentioned that you originally felt it was supernatural, then you read about the physiological. I mean, it seems like there may be two different things. Like, mine was a physiological version, and his seems more like a supernatural version.
Yeah, well, I mean, this stuff happens across the spectrum, you know, from the mildest of you can't move for a minute and you wake up to, like, the most, you know, elaborate where, you know, not only do you see a figure, but, you know, you have some kind of painful interaction with it. Like, there's a guy in my movie who talks about sort of getting attacked by metal claws, and that, you know, can feel, and it's painful as, you know, a real attack. Or a woman who, you know, was sort of sexually assaulted, you know, by a figure that she couldn't see. And, you know, it's complicated. Certainly, there's a lot of science about, you know, what's happening to your body or your brain during these experiences. And it's kind of like, for me, wherever you try to land on it, there's just a couple loose threads that complicate it. Like, if you're going to say this is just a physiological thing and these are hallucinations, the fact that different people hallucinate similar things, people who don't know each other and people who aren't drawing on some kind of common folklore. Because actually, like in Asia, there are other places where this stuff is more part of well-known folklore. And so they're seeing things that they've learned about and heard stories of all their lives. But in the U.S., it's still something that, you know, to my mind is kind of criminally underreported. I think it's like it's much more common than a lot of folks believe, and also much more dramatic. But people don't hear a lot of these stories before they happen to them. So the fact that they see similar things, you know, maybe some of the more conservative ideas about what people are seeing is, you know, like Jungian archetypes. And even that is, you know, pretty metaphysical. So, you know, it's hard to come down to one thing, or if different, or if the way you describe you and your dad are going through different experiences that, you know, just have a couple of common symptoms. Like, I know when I saw the Shadow Man, I thought that the Shadow Man had the power. I thought my being immobilized was a spell that he was casting.
Sure.
Not that some sleep REM physiological thing was creating both of these things. So, you know, I'm probably leaning towards, you know, some physiological sleep disorder thing, but it's for me a completely unsolved mystery about why people see the things that they see.
Well, it is interesting because I've had guests on talking about ayahuasca, for example, or DMT.
And absolutely, that stuff comes right up in these conversations.
That's right. They see the same things. And I've always wondered the same thing. I've always thought, well, you know, you and I both slept last night, and I guarantee we both dreamt something totally different. And I would guarantee that everybody listening to this right now dreamt of something completely different than everybody else. Well, how come when somebody goes on a DMT trip or an ayahuasca trip, why do they all see the same things? That's weird.
Yeah, well, and that's the kind of thing that suggests, you know, that it's not a hallucination that's coming from the inside, but it's something outside that's usually invisible is being made visible. You know, and in the film, you know, again, like in Room 237, I let the people who are experiencing this, you know, come to their own conclusions and speak to their experience and their search for answers. You know, and among them, you know, different folks have different points of view on that. So, yeah, that in this state, you know, people see things, and I'm certain that they see things, but, you know, and I know because I've seen them too. You know, now what's this, now where these things are coming from, you know, is something that I'm still, you know, sort of wondering about.
Now, you also mentioned earlier, I can't remember the exact phrasing that you used, but something involving the weirdness of technology.
Yeah, well, I found in talking to folks for the film, a strange amount, a surprising number of them associated their experiences with consumer technology, with like TVs and radios and telephones, you know, which is like straight out of Poltergeist. But, you know, there was a guy who's like the people on the TV started talking to him, or other folks who use the white static of televisions to kind of keep the stuff at bay. Somebody was having an out-of-body experience and was speaking to some presence, you know, over his phone while out of his body. That stuff kept coming up more often than I was expecting. I guess I was expecting it to come up, not at all.
So you're telling me that in the middle of a sleep paralysis, like say somebody fell asleep on their couch and had a sleep paralysis episode, the television would start talking to them?
Well, it actually, in the story that I'm mentioning here, it's a little more complicated than that. And, you know, like the other thing is, setting off on this, I was trying to find people who would, you know, sort of embody distinct experiences that happened across the spectrum. Say, this will be the person who has the out-of-body experience. This will be the person who sees the Shadow Man. But, you know, the categories, when you're talking to real human beings, you know, are much blurrier than that. So, like, the television one was another thing that surprised me, which was many of the people I spoke to, you know, they had sleep paralysis as they got older, but some of them had these sort of singular, unusual experiences as children that weren't necessarily sleep paralysis, but, you know, I don't know, demonstrated a proclivity towards you know, strange things happening. And one of them, you know, was he was like 4 years old and toweling off after a bath in the living room, and the television started talking to him. You know, which isn't necessarily sleep paralysis, but then he found himself having a ton of sleep paralysis. You know, actually, it began in his childhood, not much later than that. You know, and there was a woman who had a lot of sleep paralysis. I think it started in her teens, but when she was younger, like, she had this, you know, weird experience where, like, this strange red light kind of emerged from her nightlight and bathed the entire room. Another guy saw, like, handprints where other people, like, covering a room where other people didn't see them. So, yeah, on the one hand, there was more people talking about, you know, encounters that were connected with electronics. There are also these sort of strange kind of outlying events, you know, that happened to some folks when they were kids. And, you know, again, I've had maybe four sleep paralysis experiences, and the first one wasn't until, you know, my early 20s. Though I didn't have, you know, I don't remember anything really that dramatic happening to me, you know, as a kid. So it was, you know, it happened to a couple of them. You know, there never seems to be, like, this group of things happens to everyone. You know, it's everybody gets some from column A and some from column B.
Now, you mentioned white noise or the snow that you saw on old televisions. And I actually had a buddy the other day. He just, I don't know why, but he texted me and he said, do you remember when there used to be test patterns when a station would go off the air? It's kind of like, yeah, I do remember that. Kids today don't even know what that is because nothing goes off the air. Just airs 24 hours on cable all the time. But there used to be test patterns and, you know, when you're flipping through the channels, if there was nothing on that channel, it would just be snow. And sometimes you'd see something through the snow. Like, there was another channel that kind of was sort of getting ready to come through or something. It was weird. What do people say about this snow?
Well, I mean, I love that stuff that you're talking about and those mysteries of, like, the signal coming from the noise. But they were actually talking about something that was just much simpler than that, which was, I think, the environments they were in felt so chaotic and dangerous that just that snow and that static noise would kind of give them some layer of security that would kind of help drown out, you know, some of the badness in the rooms. And some of these people, one guy in particular, you know, would talk very much about, I would have this kind of experience in this one place, and I would have a different experience in another place. And he felt very, you know, very certain that he would see different things in different places, and that he would associate, and that helped suggest that, you know, what was happening wasn't, you know, an internal projection so much as a sensitivity to something that's in the environment.
Kind of reminds me, too, when you think about the white noise of the television that we don't see anymore, and you look at, like, the ghost hunters nowadays, one of the things that sometimes they bring up is that scanner, where it scans all of the white noise on the radio, and every now and then as it's scanning stations, you'll hear words. And if the words somehow magically fit together to form a sentence, this must be communication from the other side. And, you know, there's a lot of ghost hunters that say this is all bunk and you're just, you know, you're using a scanner and everything like that. But it's just interesting that that's one of the things now is another thing that kind of ties into weirdness from your youth, that weird white noise on the TV.
Yeah, well, you know, and it's seeing, you know, separating noise from signal gets really weird and complicated, because I think we do things like that, you know, just in our environment. You know, we'll see a cat face in a stain on the wall, you know, because we're sort of hardwired, you know, to look for faces.
Sure.
You know, and I think, you know,
Jesus in a tortilla.
Us, yeah, but then that got literalized by that deep dream technology that Google released. If you saw that, you put a picture in this filter. And as the filter was kind of scanning the picture, looking for faces to tag, it would kind of add them in, and it would create these very psychedelic, you know, kind of effects on images where, like, dog faces would start growing out of trees and things, and it would look for eyeballs, all over the image.
I have no idea what you're talking about, but this sounds terrifying.
Oh my God. Well, you do a search for Deep Dream. And like then they made it public and then everybody started like uploading their pictures to see what happens when it's like Google is working on technology to automate the way that it can identify pictures that it comes online. So as it's searching images for faces, somehow it starts to like enhance the pictures and put these faces in and put faces in there. And a lot of them, for some reason, look like dogs. And I actually did it and had an incredibly creepy result when I took an image from The Nightmare and I uploaded it into the software, which was probably a mistake. And there was a doorway with like a shadow man in the image, and it found this horse face in there that was completely like not part of the original image. But the crazy thing was it looked exactly like this painting that's called The Nightmare, which is part of the part of the inspiration for the film, where there's like a spirit looming over a sleeping woman, like a little gnome, and there's a horse coming up from under the shadows.
All right, I found it here. I found it here. Deep Dream. If you just Google Deep Dream, there's actually a Wikipedia page that has an example here. An image of a toast sandwich passed through the Deep Dream program. This sandwich now has eyeballs, and there's a dog face, and there's a fox face. I mean, this would be Wilson Brian Keyes. He would go crazy with this thing. There's faces everywhere.
Yeah, well, and I have to wonder how much of like human vision in like in visual processing it's emulating. I kind of think it's literalizing something that we do, you know, as we scan around the world, you know, looking for people and deciding what to focus on. I think that those images are more authentically psychedelic, you know, than a lot of art I've seen people, you know, kind of labor over.
Well, that's psychedelic, all right. I'd be on this thing all day. Deep Dream. Everybody. Well, on that topic, let's talk about your films here and get some plugs out. Obviously, Room 237 was what we discussed at the beginning, which is a look at perceived meanings in the film The Shining. And it probably would be good if you watched The Shining first and then watch Room 237. Although there are all sorts of clips from the film, so if you've never seen it, you'll get a pretty good idea of what everybody is talking about. And
well, if you've never seen The Shining, you should watch it first. But if it's been a while, I think it's fun to watch The Shining afterwards.
Sure.
To try to, you know, sort of confirm what you saw in 237.
That's right. And the other film we're talking about is, what's it called, actually? I lost my page here as I went for Deep Dream. The Nightmare, which actually just came out 2015. So it's brand new, premiered in January at the Sundance Film Festival. And that's the one that we're talking about involving the sleep paralysis and such. And I want to give you an opportunity to get some plugs out here. The films, your social media, any websites, whatever you'd like.
Well, cool. Thanks. So Room 237, is streaming on Netflix, but there's also a very nice Blu-ray DVD that you can get on Amazon with a lot of interesting hidden features, including a full-length commentary track by the mastermind, somebody who was unwilling to do an interview for the film, but came around after he saw it and takes the thing into a whole nother direction. There's The Nightmare, which is now on VOD, on iTunes and Amazon and Vudu and all those places, as well as Blu-ray DVD. It should be streaming on a major site sometime before the end of the year. My website is rodneyasher.com. There's ASCHER, where there's like links to the Facebook pages of all of those projects, as well as that short film, The S from Hell.
And obviously, go ahead.
Yeah, well, and I'm on Twitter, Rodney_Asher.
And Room 237, Google is your friend, everybody. If you just type in Room 237, if you forget how to spell Asher, rodneyasher.com, all sorts of places you can go to find out more information about this. And Rodney, I want to thank you very much for doing the show today, and maybe we'll get you back on at some point. I'll watch The Nightmare Or we can talk more about the, is it S from Hell? Is that what they refer to it as?
That's what they call it, and that's what they call the film.
That's right.
It's only a 10-minute short, and it's available in its entirety, on the S from Hell page I made for it, or on Vimeo somewhere.
I may go look for that right now, because I was unaware of that, but now I'm fascinated. All of this weird TV 70s stuff, it's fascinating to me, because I was a very, very small child then, so I vaguely remember this stuff, and I want to go check it out. But Rodney Asher, everybody, I want to thank you all for listening. We'll be back in just a moment with more After Dark Radio here on the Dark Matter Digital Network. We are back here on After Dark Radio. Brian Alvarez here, After Dark Radio on the Dark Matter Digital Network. We are live every Sunday night, 9 Pacific, midnight Eastern. Want to thank Rodney Asher for his appearance here on the show tonight, Room 237, if you want to check it out. And it is now time for some news. And some of this news may creep you out because I've got audio segments to go along with it, including some of those weird trumpet sounds that have been identified around the world. Before we get into that, however, I do want to do a quick follow-up from last week. And as I follow it up, I want to give you an opportunity to, if you are a new listener, grab a copy of last week's show. If you head to AfterDarkRadioShow.com, you can grab a copy of last week's program. Every week when this show ends, this program goes up for one full week as a free MP3 at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. After the week is over, it's gone into the archives. At WrestlingObserver.com, you can only access those as a subscriber. But hey, if you want to hear last week's show with Deborah Halber, it is up there right now as a free download at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. So head up there and check that out and download it for free. And make sure if you're listening live, you do that ASAP, because in about a half hour, it's going to be gone, replaced by this show. And we were talking about true crime over the last couple of weeks, and we were talking about Baby Doe briefly on one of the programs. And Baby Doe, according to this article at Yahoo.com, as a follow-up for last week's show, has been identified. Baby Doe identified as Bella Bond, girl found dead on Boston Harbor Shore. After a months-long campaign to learn the child's identity, and we talked about this on last week's show with Deborah Halber, a mother and her boyfriend are, quote, blaming each other for the death of a little girl who was found dead inside a trash bag on a Boston Harbor beach this summer. The girl, named Baby Doe by investigators and estimated to be 4 years old, has been confirmed as Bella Bond. Her body was found June 25th in Winthrop, Massachusetts, by a woman walking her dog, and her case sparked a massive social media campaign to find out what happened to her. Within 2 weeks, the image of the chubby-cheeked, brown-eyed girl had reached an estimated 47 million people on Facebook. So that mystery has been solved. We talked a little bit more about it on last week's show, but if you want to check out the Deborah Halber episode, it is up for free right now for live listeners at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. So head up there ASAP and check that out. On to the news for the evening. I want to start out with these trumpets. Why waste time? Everyone's got to get up for work tomorrow. And hopefully you can sleep after hearing these, because they're very, very creepy. Some people have a real hard time with these, so I should warn everybody that if you've heard these before and they've bothered you, I'm going to play them again, so maybe you don't want to listen to them. This article here from MysteriousUniverse.org, eerie unexplained trumpet sound mystifies many in Jakarta. The mysterious loud noise that ear witnesses say sounds like a trumpet calling was heard and recorded by many people this week in Jakarta, Indonesia. It is a sound that has been heard around the world for decades, yet continues to defy explanation. Jakarta residents reported hearing the trumpet-like sounds, seemingly coming from the sky around 6 to 7 p.m. on September 11. Numerous recordings were posted, comments flooded social media, and the sound was reported on local television and radio. Witnesses agreed that the sound oscillated in both intensity and loudness until finally stopping. As of this writing, no explanation has been given for the mysterious Jakarta sound. Theories abound from around the world. Similar sounds have been heard for years in the U.S., Canada, Australia, Germany, Ukraine, Belarus, Colombia, and elsewhere. The Belarus incident occurred in 2008. Appears to be the first one actually recorded. A woman in British Columbia claims to have heard it multiple times In 2013 and 2015, the panic caused by hearing a loud trumpet sound sent many to search for religious explanations, like a forewarning of the apocalypse. We're still here, so we turn to possible scientific causes. Tectonic plates rubbing together can create loud noises. Atmospheric conditions can cause variations on thunder. Tidal waves can cause shock waves and sounds. And of course, there's just plain old loud noises from trains, planes, factories, and explosions. However, none of these satisfy those who have heard it. Now, I've got three of them here. In fact, the three that were talked about here in this article. And so I'm going to play them one at a time, then we'll read a little bit more from the article about other possible explanations. And we're going to start with the Indonesia trumpet, Jakarta, Indonesia. It's about 21 seconds long, a trumpet sound heard on September 11. Oscillated, the report said, and apparently went on for quite some time, from 6 to 7 p.m. I was in the parking lot earlier today at the local Safeway, and I heard a weird noise, and of course, I just put together all of these sound clips, and I thought, what is that, the trumpet sound? Ended up being a low-flying airplane that I eventually saw, but of course, this incident with me was done and over with in about 30 seconds. These sounds, I'll play one more time, apparently oscillated for a full hour in Jakarta, Indonesia. The next one here is from Belarus. This was believed to be the first ever horn, trumpet sound, I should say, that was actually recorded. So this was from 2008 in Belarus. Now that one, I'm not going to lie, sounds a little bit like a train coming. And I don't know if maybe there was some sort of reflection off something. I will say that one would think that unless this was done deliberately as a hoax, one would think that you would know whether it was a train because you would have heard the train many, many, many times. So unless there was some sort of strange, maybe some weird anomalous situation where the echo traveled a much greater distance for the first time ever, I mean, unless this was something that people had heard for the very, very first time, I mean, one could argue maybe it was somebody recording the sounds of a train coming in the distance. So I'll play parts of that one more time. It sounds a little bit to me like a train. Now, the next one here is from the British Columbia incident. A woman in British Columbia claims that she has heard this sound multiple times in 2013 and 2015. So this one's a little bit longer. This is a trumpet sound emanating. It was recorded on video from somewhere in British Columbia. Kind of sounds like Godzilla. That one right there is probably the creepiest of them all, and the wind and the low bass rumbling actually makes the whole thing even worse. That right there from British Columbia, 2013-2015. NASA likes to talk about the natural radio signals and noises made by the Earth that humans could hear if we had secret receivers implanted in our brains. HARP gets blamed for sounds that might seem weather-related when there's no weather to relate them to. Could this be Jakarta's version of the hum? It says not likely here, since it is clearly picked up by recording equipment. Was it a frequency heard by many people? There's always aliens, it says here, running out of possible explanations. A low-flying UFO was spotted over Jakarta in July. So what did the people of Jakarta hear on September 11, 2015? Who knows, it says. Keep listening for further updates. And we have, in fact, had listeners on the show who have heard the trumpet noises themselves, and have claimed they're going to send some to me. I'm still waiting for them. So if you've got any comments on this, you can contact me. Let me know on Twitter here, at Brian Alvarez. I'll be monitoring it throughout the show here. Also, emails, brian@wrestlingobserver.com. If you'd like to send me an email there, brian@afterdarkradioshow.com. Works just fine as well. And we had a lot, actually, of these emails about the Berenstain Bears last week. A bird here says, I used to send a lot of wrestling stuff in, but I have been laid up in the hospital recently. I'm trying to get back on my feet. I've called into the wrestling show before. Should be familiar with me. The point of this email is I wanted to get your opinion on a subject that I think would fit After Dark Radio just perfect. About 8 years ago, I had a dream where I was walking hand in hand with the most beautiful girl I'd ever seen at a park. I had the most tranquil feeling just being around her. I had never seen this girl before. 1 year later, I get a new job, and I end up meeting the girl from the dream. I could not believe it. I wanted to get with her, but she had a boyfriend and shot me down. What I wanted to know is it possible to tap into alternate dimensions and realities through dreams? The park I had the dream about also happened to be across the street from the new job, and I never was at that park before in my life. Very strange. And that is from Bert. Many times I thought about dreams and the predictive abilities of them. And usually, as a skeptic, I err on the side of coincidence. For example, if there was a terrible airliner crash tomorrow, the fact that there are millions and millions and millions of people in the United States, odds are that many of them, I shouldn't say many of them, a large, let's just say hundreds of them, hundreds of people tonight, whether a plane crashes tomorrow or not, hundreds of people tonight around this country are probably going to have a dream that an airplane crashes. And so should an airplane happen to crash tomorrow, all of those people are going to think they predicted the future. But in reality, odds are any event that somebody could imagine in their head, whether that be an accident, maybe tomorrow the stock market has a gigantic crash. Guaranteed, some stockbroker somewhere tonight has a nightmare that the stock market crashes and there's a huge financial disaster. Somebody somewhere dreams about virtually everything. Now, if you dream of a person that you have never seen before, you dream of a person, you've never met them, you don't know anything about them, but you remember what they look like, and then a year later, you get a new job, you move, but one way or another, you run into the same person that was in your dream. Those things I cannot explain, because that goes to me a little bit beyond coincidence. I don't know what that means. And maybe every night you dream of a different girl and you, I don't know. I don't remember. Listen, 99% of my dreams, I don't remember. So Maybe I've dreamed of some imaginary face, and down the road someday I may meet that face. Who knows? So I don't have a good explanation for that. I have a much better explanation for random generic dreams of good news, bad news, world events happening to coincidentally coincide with actual events. But something like that, I cannot explain. So thank you very much for that email. All right, this September 23rd thing. It's a couple days away here. It is my wife's birthday. And apparently a lot of people think that the end is here. I don't. Trust me. This is my third radio show today. I got one more coming. And believe me, I don't want to go out like this. That first one I did today was a disaster. If I'm going to go out at the end of the world, I want to at least have a few excellent shows under my belt before that happens. And this here is from the Daily Mail. It's not really so much about September 23rd, but Graham Hancock, who has been a guest many times on the Dark Matter Digital Network, does believe that within 20 years, a comet big enough to end life as we know it could hit the Earth, trigger epic floods. Around the world, from Alaska and Indonesia, more than 200 ancient myths tell of a human civilization brought to an end by flood and fire. Compelling scientific evidence, which began to emerge only in 2007, indicates that these stories, such as the tale of Noah and the Ark, are based on hard fact. A cataclysm, it says here, rocked our planet 12,800 years ago, causing mass extinctions of large animals such as the mammoth, sloth bears, all but wiping out our own race. An entire episode in the human story was rubbed out, a chapter not of unsophisticated hunter-gatherers, but of advanced technology. All the signs are that remnants of this civilization struggled on, sustained by a few individuals who knew the secrets of the former age. To their primitive contemporaries, it appeared that they possessed magical powers, holy powers. They were what Graham Hancock calls the magicians of the gods. Hancock says, these magicians left a message for us, not a metaphysical, spiritual message, but a direct and urgent warning. What happened before can happen again. What destroyed their world can destroy ours. These warnings have gone unheeded for millennia. And now, Hancock says, we have scientific evidence to decode them, but it is almost too late. Within the next 20 years, Earth faces a catastrophe 1,000 times worse than the detonation of every nuclear weapon on the planet, a collision with the remnants of a comet big enough to end all life as we know it. To understand what that could mean, we need to look back at the tumultuous epoch between 10,800 and 9,800 BC. So Hancock believes this cataclysm rocked the planet, and now, in the early 21st century here, we may be 20 years or less away from another comet remnant hitting the Earth and wiping us out. And I guess the only good news, if you want to call it that, is that it may not be taking place Wednesday, which is honest to God what I'm hoping. Because I've got gifts on the way for my wife, and she would be very, very upset if the world happened to end that day. The reality of the situation, I was reading, and you know what? Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. Maybe the world ends Wednesday. But I was reading about Paul Harvey, and I don't know if Paul Harvey really said this or if it was just attributed to Paul Harvey. But essentially, and this is not an exact quote, he said that everybody believes that this is the first time we've seen something, this is all new, and in reality, it's all happened a million times. And the story of the world coming to an end, I mean, it's only been 3 years since 2012. And I was growing up, 2012 was for sure going to be the end. And I remember even prior to that, my mom remembers when she was a kid, there were these random dates in the 60s where the world was allegedly going to come to an end. And one time after another, these alleged end-of-the-world stories have turned out to, in fact, not be the case. So therefore, very, very skeptical that the end of the world is, in fact, on its way. I think that we'll be okay next week. I got a guest booked, and so I sincerely hope that Wednesday is not the end. A couple of Twitter notes here on the trumpets. Freedom here says, glad you mentioned the trumpets. I heard the trumpets two times in 2013. Kalamazoo, Michigan literally rattled me both times. And obviously, if anybody's listening to this and you happen to hear the trumpets, please grab that iPhone. It's got a digital recorder on it. Record them and send them to me. I'd love to play them here on the show. Paragamer here says the Screen Gems logo does indeed have an adverse effect on me. And he has a, in fact, I'll retweet this right now. He's sending me a picture of the logo where if you look at it, it does in fact look like two red, evil, angry eyes. And I've just retweeted that at Brian Alvarez on Twitter. Tom says it looks like an owl. Keith says, I hope you ordered an asteroid or a huge black hole for her birthday. I hope not. I sincerely hope not. Some other stories here. Oh, this is another weird one. Not a comment, but this is from the New York Post. Why do smart people believe Mercury retrograde ruins their lives? It says here, if you spilled a whiskey all over your computer or signed a lease for a bedbug-filled apartment, relax. It's probably not your fault. It's probably Mercury retrograde. The astrological phenomenon, which started Thursday and goes until October 9th, is the hottest scapegoat in town. The juice cleanse of the cosmos. According to astrological hucksters, the three periods each year when Mercury appears to be moving backwards are total pandemonium. Time when the stars are liable to wreak havoc on technical devices, morning commutes, and official documents. New York Post, however, says it's total nonsense. It is not responsible for the G train being late, your iPhone freezing up. Yet the belief, it says, in the Mercury retrograde is getting stronger and stronger. This author here, Tim Donnelly, and actually two authors, Robert Rourke, say that they are on social media and their feeds are filled with comments from otherwise logical, educated people who take the phenomenon seriously. Says one friend, a female writer in Brooklyn, posted on Facebook recently, is Mercury still in retrograde? Emails have been getting misplaced like a mofo over on my end. And a business consultant friend in South Carolina says she, quote, won't sign official documents or finalize during a retrograde. Now, I will say something from doing this show here for a while. New York Post is very, very skeptical of this Mercury retrograde ruining lives. But I know there are people listening right now who probably would alert me that their lives are being poorly and desperately and badly affected by this Mercury retrograde. If you're one of those people, feel free to contact me on Twitter. We don't have time for calls tonight at Brian Alvarez. But I have learned from doing this show, there's a lot of things that people believe are bunk, but there's a lot of listeners on this show that are living these things right now. So is Mercury in retrograde affecting you? At Brian Alvarez. Apparently, if you go to mysteriousuniverse.org, there is a video of a pterodactyl. And quite frankly, hate to say it, it's not very good. But if you want to check it out, you can go up there. It's actually a very good CGI job, in my opinion. And mysteriousuniverse.org, you should check it out if for no other reason than there is a pretty cool article about how, while the video is not real, there are a lot of reports, still to this day, of people that claim that they have seen pterodactyls, pterosaurs, the dinosaur, the flying leathery dinosaur with the long bill. And if you want to see a pretty cool video, it's up at mysteriousuniverse.org as well. This here, Life on Mars, a scientist, Louis Dadernell, which appears to have been spelled very, very poorly by the Express in the UK. They may have spelled his name wrong. He believes early microscopic forms of life may well have formed on Mars billions of years ago, but a major environmental event later made the red planet completely inhospitable, even to the single-celled organisms it may have formed. He is the author of The Knowledge, How to Rebuild Our World from Scratch. It is a New York Times and Sunday Times best-selling book explaining how to rebuild society in the event of an apocalypse, which we may need on Wednesday, it looks like, by the way. And he believes that something catastrophic has gone wrong on Mars environmentally. The atmosphere has been blown into space, he says. It is too cold and dry for any life now. And apparently he believes that I guess possibly, in some ways, I guess I'll read this here. His hypothesis that Mars may have housed early life comes just weeks after NASA revealed its Curiosity rover space probe had found unexpectedly high levels of water beneath the surface of Mars, and also separate evidence that it once had a continental crust much like ours. Could Mars, life on Mars, or a comet have seeded life on Earth? It is something that people have discussed for a long time. And unfortunately, that is it for today. We're out of time. I'd love to read more of these, but we got to wrap it up. Don't forget, if you're a new listener or if you listen occasionally, we are here live every Sunday night, 9 Pacific, midnight Eastern. And if you missed any portion of this program, it is going to be up as a free MP3 download in about 15 minutes at the website, afterdarkradioshow.com. And I want to thank everybody for listening tonight. We had a ton of listeners. It's been growing. It actually grew a lot this week. And so I politely request that if you have friends interested in these sort of topics, spread the word about After Dark Radio. It is, of course, free as part of the Dark Matter Digital Network on TuneIn Radio. Anybody can listen to it anywhere in the world that they have an internet connection. So spread the word to your friends on social media. Send them emails, afterdarkradioshow.com. We got a lot of great shows and a lot of great guests coming up. So thanks again, everybody. We are completely out of time. I want to thank, of course, Keith Rowland, our illustrious webmaster, the great Art Bell, and all of you, the listeners. We'll talk to you next week, After Dark Radio, here on the Dark Matter Digital Network.